Accession number 30,001, Mr. Peter Est, Reel 27. Now, was there anything else, any other sort of operational or flights or that you recall during your time commanding Fire Squadron? Or was it just more practice flying?
Yeah, in July, for instance. We're still on the FP1. We're doing flypast rehearsals.
Now that might be because on 24th, the one ceremony you did have, which was perhaps we'll talk about that while you think about it. You were given your squadron standard.
Oh yes, yes.
What do you remember of that? How important is that?
That was in April 1954.
Now, the book seems to imply it was almost given because the squadron had improved, but I would have thought the squadron standard was just given at any time, as and when. What do you think of it?
I'm just trying to think. In 1954, squadron would be about 30 years old, somewhere, I think. Probably formed in 1914. No, that'd be 40 years old. It might have been that. I can't.
Well, what was the what ceremonies and what sort of general?
Oh, a very big parade. I've got some wonderful photographs of. But we had the whole squadron on parade, plus support from two other squadrons. But we were up front to receive the standard, and I had a young flying officer who was the chap, he's a smart chap, and he was the one who was going to actually receive the standard and march past with it. And the chap who presented the squadron standard was Air Chief Marshal Sir Leslie Hollinghurst, who had been in the squadron in the 1920s. He'd retired when he came to present the standard, and he flew in with the CNC of Germany, Harry Broadhurst, it was a very good day. The weather was good. There was a huge crowd of people there, as onlookers, or whatever you like to call them, spectators, and after the parade was over, we adjourned to the officers' mess, where we had a formal luncheon, and the two commanders in chief were there, and lots of guests.
Now, anything else? What else do you remember from this time? Then you seem to have moved to Fatsburg in October 55.
In 55, yes.
On the border.
Yes, yes, that was right up close to the Russian front.
Now tell me about that.
Well, first of all, the reason we went there was because the Russians were being a bit naughty and flying over crossing the border with their aircraft to have a look-see, I think, and see what we were up to. Not only us, but all the stations in Germany. So they decided to put us up close to the border, and I suppose it was effective in some way. It stopped the Russians playing their tricks.
How did it stop them? I mean,
well, because we used to patrol up and down the border at about anywhere between 20,000 and 40,000 feet.
And would you intercept anyone who came over?
Well, we didn't.
Or did they just not do it when you were there?
They stopped doing it. Yeah. So we didn't have anything such as that.
There seems to have been a problem about landing there in certain wind conditions.
Without you going over. Because we were so close to the border, we used to do a thing called a QGH, which was a letdown. So you had to be overhead of your own airfield at 20,000 feet. And then you come under the control of the ground. You do everything that they told you. So what they used to do, if that was your airfield, you were 20,000 feet, they'd take you down in one direction, depending on the wind direction, down to 10,000 feet, and then you turn on a reciprocal heading and come there down the other 10,000 feet, so they bring you onto the airfield. Well, now, if the wind was a westerly wind, as it often was, by being from 20,000 feet over the airfield, then coming down to 10,000 feet, meant that we would cross the border because we were so close to it. So we never did our letdowns in that direction from what we call a QGH, which was the controlled letdown. So we always did them to the west, regardless of the wind direction. So it came down that way, away from the border, and then came in over the airfield. And then normally they would bring you straight in line with the runway, and you'd just go on and land. So when you got into the airfield circuit, you had to do a circuit of the airfield and come in and land after that.
And that worked?
Oh, yes.
Did you ever cross over Soviet airspace deliberately? I mean, they crossed over into yours. Did you ever do it to them?
Never, no.
Now, how long were you at? You went there in October 55. How long were you there for, Bunstorf? At Passburg? Or was it just for a short while?
I finished my time with the squadron at Passburg.
So the second base, that was where you stayed?
Yeah, yes.
Now, anything else you remember about your time with the squadron? Because, you know, it's a big thing. It's your big squadron command. I just wonder if there's...
Yes. Well, we had some very good results on the air firing, by the way, at Sylt. We became with the top squadron out of all the squadrons in Germany on the air firing results, because they used to count the... And we really did very well.
Was the improvement measured in any other ways?
Yes.
Flying hours?
Yes, flying hours. We did more flying hours than any other squadron in 2nd TAF. There were a lot of squadrons in 2nd TAF in those days throughout the whole of Germany. And they used to monthly send in... they used to get all the hours together from all the squadrons at headquarters and send a copy of these to every squadron and every station. Most occasions, we were top with a number of flying hours.
Now, how did you feel when you left the squadron? Because you must have known,
two and a half years.
You leave in April 56? March or April? You go to Hornchurch in April.
Yes, I went to Hornchurch in March 56.
March, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Now, how did you feel about it? Because that was... did you know it was the end of your operational flying?
Oh yes, yes.
And how did you feel about it?
2.5 years is your time.
But how did you feel? Did you realise you'd never fly operationally again, or?
No. No, I didn't know what was going to happen to me.
So as far as you were concerned, you didn't know that was the end of operational flying?
No.
Now, what were you posted to? What was your next posting?
I was then posted in the March of 56 to the Aircrew Selection Centre at Hornchurch.
Now, what was your job there? You were a staff officer, weren't you?
No, not initially.
I was a
selection officer. We used to work in pairs. And they had all these civilian candidates through, and we put them into overalls and gave them a number, or letter and a number, on their backs. So we didn't know their names, we didn't know anything about them, apart from the fact that we used to have six in a group. and they would be sitting in front, we'd be sitting in the hall there, and we asked them to do various things, and we had some equipment there, and they sort of.
So what sort of tests and commands are there?
Well, it was really to see if we could find who was likely to be a leader. Sometimes you'd give the one chap, make him a leader, and then give them all a turn at that, see how they go, and we would write them up accordingly. Another time you'd say, all right, now you're on this exercise, we're not going to appoint a leader, we're going to leave it to you to sort things out, and then you'd see who would naturally become a leader amongst them.
And what sort of tests were they given?
They would, we would sort of have a so-called river, and they had to have a box one side and a box the other. They had to get from one side to the other without touching the ground in between. And they had all sorts of equipment, ropes and wooden frames, and so they could use these things to help them do the particular task that they were detailed to do.
So what they normally call command tasks now. Anything else that you do?
We would interview them, of course.
Now, what were the interviews like?
Well, we used to want to know why they wanted to join the Air Force, and what they'd done in the past, if they'd been a member of the ATC cadets, you know, the Air Transport, Air Training Corps, or anything like that, or some of them been at schools where they had school units, and we'd ask them about them, and try to just find out what they'd been doing and what their aims were, why they wanted to join the Air Force, and so on, whether they'd done any flying before, just really going into their past lives and what their aims were for future.
Now, you eventually move to a staff role, don't you, at the same place?
Yes. Well, after I'd been selecting for about 6 months, I think it was, the commandant was an Air Commodore, Corbally. And he was in need of a new staff officer. And he asked me to go and see him. He said, Peter, he said, I want you to become my staff officer. I'm in need of a new one. And you've now been with us about 6 months, so you know what goes.
This is Air Commodore Teddy Corbally.
That's it.
What would you actually do for him? I mean,
well, whenever he decided he wanted to introduce some, say, new scheme, I would then go ahead and organise it on his behalf. And sometimes he would want to go around and see the chaps on these exercises, interviews, and the sort of things I've just been describing. I'd walk around with him. Sometimes he had to go up to meetings in the Air Ministry, and on a couple of occasions I went with him on those. So I was working closely with him pretty well all the time, running the show.
Now, Hannah, anything else you remember about that time? You were doing that, what, 2 years?
Yes. Pretty well, I think.
So 56 to 58?
That's right. That's right.
Now, anything else about... I mean, I know there's less to remember about that kind of desk job,
yes,
what do they call it?
Staff job. Well, one thing that they had two chipmunk aircraft there, and I used to get quite a lot of flying in. And of course, I was able to do it more easily by being the CO's, the commandant staff officer, than if I'd been on selecting. So it was quite good.
Did you enjoy flying the chipmunk? Have you flown before? new trainer, or the new then? Would you like to fly?
Nice little aeroplane. Chipmunk.
So what happens next then? What's your next job?
Let's have a look. Oh,
did you stay at Hornchurch when you were working as staff officer to Corbley?
Yes.
It's still the same place.
Yes. They eventually moved to Biggin Hill, but it was way after I left them.
And in 1958, you seem to have gone to the Air Ministry.
Yes. Then in July 1958, I was posted to Air Ministry on the policy side of postings. Aircrew selection. With my experience of having been a selector and then being commandant to the staff officer of the commandant, they decided that I was the sort of chap with the necessary experience they required.
So what was this unit called?
It was called M3.
Yeah.
And then I think they had SEL2 selection too. I was on that job for 3.5 years.
And that's at the Air Ministry?
Yes.
Whereabouts is that? Are you in?
That was in a Dastrell house in Theobald's Road, which is off Southampton Row. And I used to go up every day by train because I used to work in civilian clothes there.
Yeah. So what were your duties there?
Responsible for all policy making and introduction of any new schemes with regard to aircrew coming into the new aircrew coming
now,
into the
what
area.
What kind of policy were you dealing with then? I mean, what sort of policy? What were the hot potatoes at the time?
I can't think of anything in particular.
So it was more a routine job?
Yes.
It wasn't anything major, it was just...
Yes. Hornchurch, and there was another selection centre for ground officers. And they came under our organisation. But we had another chap in my office. He dealt with them, and I dealt with the air crew side.
So what would you spend your day doing, or is it blurred away now?
I can't remember in detail what I did do. But I mean, when they had policy changes, we had to make sure that they were introduced properly, and they happened occasionally. I can't remember which policy changes happened at the time, but. We were pretty busy anyway.
So how long were you there for?
I was there for 3.5 years.
So from 58, July 58...
From July 58 to... up to the end of December 61.
What was your next posting?
And then I went to Halton, number one School of Technical Training.
Now, what was your job there?
As a squadron commander.
Now, what does that mean? Because it doesn't mean quite the same as it normally does it?
No, it's not. No aircraft. Or at least there were some aircraft there, but there were nothing to do with my job. They had two wings, the junior wing and the senior wing. The junior wing was where you had people for their first year in as aircraft apprentices. And had in the junior wing, they had three squadrons, and I was commanding number one squadron. And we had a wing commander in charge of the wing. In my squadron, I had approximately 200 apprentices. And it was rather like being a headmaster at a school. They would come in, straight from civilian life, anywhere between the ages of about 16 and 18.
What quality of intake were they? What were they like as lads?
They were really very good. Very good. But when they came, of course, they were all very strange. They'd never been in uniform before. Never. Some of them had been in the ATC, of course. So they'd had a little experience from that point of view. when we got them in, we split them into two flights, A flight and B flight. And I had a flight lieutenant in charge of each flight. And they had their NCOs, they had a sergeant each and two corporals. So each flight had a flight lieutenant officer, a sergeant and two corporals. And I was over them all, but I had the senior NCO, a flight sergeant, as my senior NCO, and he and I used to work closer together. The first thing we had to do when we got them in was to set about getting them into uniform. So we had a very big store, and they would go down and be fitted out for their uniforms and come back. And we had a barrack block as our headquarters, and it had two floor levels, and one side was A flight, one side was B flight, and they each had their own bed, and then they had to be taught how to fold their bedding up, and had to be left absolutely immaculate every morning. And then once a week they'd have a cleaning session, and they'd have to clean the wooden floors, polish them, and make them really shine. And they used to have to keep the place tidy and never make a mess anywhere. And my NCOs and my flight commanders would look after those angles. And when the chaps first came in, obviously it took them a little while to get used to the routine. And they got into it fairly well. And I had one of my NCOs, a sergeant. I was named Sergeant Cook. He used to set up a band with bagpipes. He used to teach them to play the bagpipes. And by the time, at the end of the year, we had our bagpipe band, and the chap in the front with the old, the mace, he used to throw it around, and they were really good, and he used to get them practicing in the evenings and so on, and they were excellent, and we used them on parade. They were so good because we used to give them a lot of drill, and I was always out there watching the standards of their drill and with their flight commanders, and then once a week on a Saturday we'd have a squadron drill parade. Give them all the feeling of the whole squadron.
Do you think drill was important to the boys?
Oh yes.
What way? What did it sort out for them?
Well, it made them stand up straight. It made them hold their heads back, and when they walked, they had to march. When they first started to march, of course, some of them hadn't a clue, so we had to teach them how to quick march off with the left foot, and then there was a slow march, there's normal march, normal pace march, and then there's a slow march where you would go slowly with the legs, and then we taught them all of that over time, not in 5 minutes, of course, and so by the end of their first year, in addition to doing the drill side of things, they used to attend technical lectures. in the technical wing, which I had no responsibility for.
Now, one of the things you seem to believe in was the importance of a sympathetic approach. Now, not everyone does.
Yes.
I
can tell you one case that comes to mind. I had one chap, he hadn't been with us long, 2 or 3 weeks maybe, and he said he wanted to see me. He said, "So I'd like to go, I don't want to carry on any longer." So I had a talk to him, and I said, "Have you thought about this carefully?" He said, "Yes." So I said, "Have you spoken to your parents about it?" He said, "No." So I said, "Well, I think it'd be a good idea if you spoke to your parents." And I said, "What's the number?" So I dialed it up. I said, "Now look, I'm going to hand the phone over to you. I'm going to walk out of my office, close the door, and leave you here. And you talk to your parents, and come out when you're finished." So sometimes, you know, I had 2 or 3 chaps like that, and they came out, and in every case, they decided that they were going to stay on, and they did well.
So you think if you just shouted at them, or tried to buck them up
I never shouted at them. No.
Another thing you used to do is you used to give them air experience flights, because there weren't many of you.
Oh yes, well, there were only about 4 of us, I think, who were pilots of the staff officers there. There's a lot of officers at Horton, mainly technical officers. So, when we weren't, all the chaps were either at their lectures or doing drill or whatever, I used to go down to the airfield, get in a chipmunk, and used to take about 4 at a time, give them about a quarter of an hour each, quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, flying experience.
Was this part of the syllabus or was it informal?
Yeah. No, it was part of the syllabus to give them air experience, and it was really good, so I used to get quite a lot of flying. Admittedly, you know, it was getting airborne, and I said, always asked them if they'd been airborne before. A number of them had, with the ATC, but never. I said, "All right, well, now I'm going to give you the opportunity to try handling the controls." I said, "Control column is between your legs, and if you move it forward, it pushes the nose down. If you ease the back, pulls the nose up. If you move it to the left, it'll tilt the aircraft to the left and right." And they're the sort of simple effects of the controls. And then you've got the rudder bars, and you have to work those in conjunction with the ailerons. So I said, "Now," I used to sit in front, and behind. I said, "You put your hands and feet on the controls and just get a feel for it." And I said, "Yes, you seem to have got quite a good idea." I said, "Right, now, have another go now, and I'm going to let you fly it." So I used to put my hands up in the air so they could see that my hands were not controlling. I used to take my feet off the rudder pedals, and I used to tell them, "Right, now ease the stick forward a bit, now ease it back a bit, now turn slight left, turn left, turn, stick over to the left, left rudder, bit of left rudder, and hold it there, and now you want to straighten out again, so ease the stick over to the right, centralise the rudder, and you're flying straight and level again." And I used to give them just simple stuff like that, and they used to enjoy that.
Just a bit of a taster.
Yeah, just that's all it was. I mean, only airborne for about 20 minutes, so but nevertheless, it was a taster. Yeah.
Anything else about your time there? Any other things that you remember?
Well, on the flying side, I remember, in addition to doing that simple stuff, I'd give them a couple of aerobatics, a loop or a roll or both. So, and then I'd